It's my pleasure at this point to introduce Professor David Schatz. Professor Schatz is the professor of philosophy at Yeshiva University. He's the associate professor of religion at Columbia and the editor of the Torah Mata Journal. He has smicha from Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He earned his PhD in general philosophy from Columbia. Those of you who know Professor Schatz's work know that he has published many books, over many 50 or more articles and reviews dealing with both general and Jewish philosophy, on the theory of knowledge, on free will, ethics, philosophy of religion, focusing on the Rambam, on 20th century philosophical figures, and of course on Rav Soloveitchik. He's the editor of the Mozar HaRav series, which we're selling outside, which is devoted to publishing manuscripts by Rav Soloveitchik. He's the co-editor of the series' first volume, Family Redeemed, Essays on Family Relationships. He has been chosen 5 times as the outstanding professor by the senior class of Stern College. And we could go on and on and on. Personally speaking, Rav Schatz, Professor Schatz, has been very important to me in terms of what I've read and how I've thought. I especially remember, this will sound quirky, but I remember an essay that you published on why 351 of the guide is really the end of the guide and not 354 in some, I think it was Edwin Mellon Press, some obscure volume. But anyway, that was very helpful to me in terms of how I thought about the guide. I've read Professor Schatz very closely for many years. I consider him to be a great figure of intellectual honesty, of careful reading, of textual analysis, and it's my honor to introduce him to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that introduction. I was at Torah in Motion a couple of years ago, and I guess since my name is Schatz and this is a return visit, you can call it the Chazoras HaShatz. Today I'm going to be speaking about Rav Soloveitchik's view on evil. And of course, every time you try to interpret the particular thinker, there's always the danger that you're going to project your own thoughts onto that other thinker. The very first time I did any public speaking, I was asked to talk on the topic Maimonides, his life and thought. And a postcard went out to announce this talk. But there was a slight error on the postcard. One word was left out. So what it said is, Dr. David Schatz will speak on his life and thought. So I told them that on the subject of Maimonides, I wasn't the world's greatest expert, but on the subject of my own life and thought, I certainly was. But my mother was in the audience, and she said that she's the greatest expert on me. Just one third preliminary joke. It's a story that about Rav Schechter, actually, who's not here. It was told to me by Dr. David Berger, you know, who my brother-in-law will be speaking later in the month for Torah in Motion. He's an eminent historian, so when he tells me something about the past, I believe it. What he said is, you know, the Rav was known, as some of you may have gathered, as a terror in Shir, at least until the late 1960s. And people were mortally afraid of being called on. So Rav Schechter used to sit near the front. What people did is they lined up their seats, which were sort of desks, behind him so that the Rav could only see him and not see them. On one occasion, Rav Schechter bent over to take a sefer from underneath the seat, at which time everybody behind him bent over. It was like trees being knocked over in a hurricane. Anyway, in the late 1950s, Rav Soloveitchik wrote an article in which the following sentence appears: "Hachavaya hadatit, chavayat sevel hi," which means religious experience is the experience of, well, you could say in the first instance, a burden, but what really means is, what it can also mean is suffering. Religious experience is the experience of suffering. And this is a view that he actually had pronounced already back in 1944 in a footnote in Isha Halacha, Halachic Man, where he wrote as follows: "Religion is not, at the outset, a refuge of grace and mercy for the despondent and desperate, an enchanted stream for crushed spirits. But a raging, clamorous torrent of man's consciousness with all its crises, pangs, and torments. In other words, it is difficult to be a yid. It is difficult to be religious. Religion is not meant to make you feel good. Religion very often goes along with crisis, pang, and torment. And Rav Soloveitchik saw this view emblemized, by, if there is such a word, by certain motifs in our literature. So, for example, when Hashem appears to Iov at the end of Sefer Iov, how does he appear to him? He appears to him out of min ha-sa'ara, out of the whirlwind, hence the title of this book about evil, out of the whirlwind. When he appears to Yechezkel, it's with a bewildering array of sights and of sounds. Avraham has to go through the Akedah. We remember every morning Zechiras Amalek. We have to remember what happened, what Amalek did to us. These are all terrible experiences. But the Rav believed that these kinds of experience are part and parcel of Jewish existence. And so he spent a lot of time, and he spent a lot of time dealing with them. In fact, in the book Out of the Whirlwind, you see him dealing with it from all points of view. He deals with it through biblical interpretation. He deals with it through Talmudic interpretation, halachic interpretation. He deals with it through philosophical discourses. He deals with it through eulogies, from all sides, attacking the problem and surrounding it. Why? Why this emphasis upon suffering? Why did it have so focal a place in his thought? I think that there are two answers. One is biographical, and the other one is philosophical. Biographically, the Rav himself suffered. He had a bout of colon cancer at the end of the 1950s, 1959, 1960. And in the year 1967, as you heard previously, he lost in a very short span, 4 or 5 months, his mother, his brother, and his wife. And the essays in this book, some of them, date from shortly after these experiences. And the Rav actually wrote about the experiences, and I'd like to read you one passage from Out of the Whirlwind, which I think is particularly moving. He writes, "When I eulogized my uncle, Ravelvel Soloveitchik," that is the Brisker Rav as he was known, "in the auditorium of Yeshiva University, while knowing of my affliction," he knew he was ill, but he hadn't told people, "one nagging thought assailed my mind. All these thousands of people are healthy and expect to live a long and happy life, whereas I am not certain that I will be able to accompany my daughter to the wedding canopy." At that time, his daughter Tova was engaged to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. "While these thoughts are passing through one's mind with the speed of lightning, one feels forsaken, forlorn, and lonely." And he continues, "The night before my operation, when my family said goodbye to me, I understood the words of the psalmist, 'Ki ovi v'imi azavuni, v'Hashem ya'asveni,' when my mother and my father forsake me, the Lord will take me up." I had never understood this verse. Did ever a parent abandon his child? Of course not. Yet in certain situations, one is cut off even from his parents or his beloved wife and children. Suddenly one realizes that there is no help which his loved ones are able to extend to him. They are onlookers who watch a drama unfolding itself with unalterable speed. They are not involved in it. I stand before God. No one else is beside me." An interesting footnote to that passage. This passage appears in the manuscript from which we, I was one of the co-editors of this volume, from which we prepared this essay. And Rabbi Reuven Ziegler, one of the other co-editors, showed this to Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, and she said, "It's impossible that my father would have said this in public." And Rabbi Ziegler said, "But it's right there in the manuscript, and the manuscript is what he was working from when he spoke." And she said, "It's impossible." Sure enough, we got the tape in which he delivered the manuscript. This part that I just read was not there. Very interesting. In any case, one of the reasons, then, I think Rav Soloveitchik was interested in the problem of suffering is that he suffered himself. There was another reason, too, and this one, I think, was philosophical. And that is that he believed that it is somehow a spiritual experience to go through suffering. Rav Soloveitchik distinguishes between pain and suffering. A woman in childbirth is experiencing great pain, but she's not experiencing suffering. A man who has cancer and doesn't feel pain but knows he's ill is experiencing suffering without pain. These are distinct. And what he tended to do here is to see suffering as something which is sort of part of the animal nature, whereas suffering is part of our human nature. What basically is suffering, he says? It belongs to the spiritual personality. Man realizes his uniqueness and otherness as a being who is not just part of the physical, chemical world. Suffering, depression, grief, these things actually elevate man above the beasts. Now, you might want to quarrel with this as an empirical claim, but the point is that he believed that this is part of our Tzelem Elokim. You know, you all know that people think that, anxiety is a particularly Jewish trait. I'll tell you a story about that. There were these two Jews who hatched a plot to assassinate the Tsar. And they knew that the Tsar was going to be coming through a certain area at 2 o'clock. So they managed to finagle their way over there, and they lay in ambush. 2 o'clock, Tsar doesn't come, not there. They wait more. 2:30, not there. 3 o'clock, not there. 3:30, he's not there. Finally, one Jew turns to the other and he says, "Oi, I hope nothing happened to him." In any case, what I would like to do over the next 4 hours is to try to describe what I think is Rav Soloveitchik's contribution to the problem of evil. I tell you that those of you who are familiar with Rav Soloveitchik's views on evil may be surprised by what I am going to say, because it's not the standard line about what he teaches. I'll later relate what I do think he teaches to the standard understanding. I think that he really holds to both, but I'm going to be emphasizing a different point than the usual. But I have to start with Chazal. Why is there evil in the world? Well, for many people, there is one and only one Jewish view. And that is, Chazal say, "Ein misa b'li chet v'ein yisurin b'lo ova," that there is no death without sin and no suffering without transgression. And this is taken to be the Jewish view exclusively. Well, it is true that, quote, Chazal say that, but actually it's a particular member of Chazal, some named Rav Ami. The Gemara in Shabbos takes Rav Ami's position, minds it, explores it, examines it, tests it, and it comes to the conclusion that Rav Ami is wrong. Te yufta de Rav Ami te yufta. There are people who die without having sinned, and there are people, as Tosis points out, one can extrapolate, who suffer without having sinned either. This is a rejection of the kind of classical theodicy. Theodicy means, it's a term coined by Leibniz, it means the explanation of God's justice. It's an explanation of evil, trying to show that God is just. David Berger, who I mentioned before, once asked the question on the exam, I think it was he who did this, he asked the question to define theodicy, and someone wrote, "It's a work by Homer." Anyway, just to show you how complicated this whole question is, that same statement by Rav Ami appears in the Medrash as well, but there it appears without the refutation. So the Medrash seems to endorse Rav Ami, or at least not refute him, and the Talmud Bavli seems to accept. But there are other explanations given by Chazal. My colleague at Yeshiva, Dr. Yaakov Elman, has written several articles outlining them and discussing them in detail. One is, for example, the idea that sometimes when there is a plague, then even innocent people will be harmed by the plague. You see this in the famous, with Rashi mentions that when the Jews are not supposed to go out of their homes on the night that the destroyer is coming through Egypt, Rashi explains because once Rishus is given to the Mashris, once the destroyer has been given permission to kill, then Eino Machin Bein Tzadik LaRasha, he no longer differentiates between the Tzadik and the Rasha. Sometimes you find the idea that suffering or death is a kapara. It is atonement. That's also different from the sort of classical theodicy. Sometimes you find the idea that it is that suffering can be yisurin shel ahava, which means tribulations of love, which is usually interpreted to mean that one suffers more in this world in order to have the reward increased in the next world. One can also understand yisurin shel ahava differently, and that is that God inflicts suffering on the righteous in order to allow them the opportunity to rise to even higher levels of faith. I should mention also that the classic theodicy is also actually rejected in the book of Eov, the book of Job. Because what happens in Job? Job goes through this extraordinary suffering. Then his friends talk to him for chapters upon chapters. And as the expression goes, with friends like that, who needs enemies? They tell him God is just. They tell him you must have done something wrong, otherwise you wouldn't be suffering. But what happens at the end of the book? Chapter 42, God appears and God tells the friends that Eov is going to have to pray for you. Ki lo dibartem elai nechona k'avdi Eov. You did not speak properly to me or about me, as did my servant Eov. Now this is amazing because Eov was almost on the verge of blaspheming God. They didn't get there, but it was on the verge of it. The friends are the ones who said over and over and over, God is just, God is just, God is just, you must have sinned. Yet God gets angry at the friends rather than getting angry at Eov. What does that suggest? What it suggests is that the friends were making God look bad by implying that he would hold a person like Eov to be a Rasha. It's an insult to God to think that he has such crazy and unfair moral standards. It's a rejection of the idea that all suffering is punishment for sin. And indeed, Eov is not punished for sin. So the theodicy that says that all suffering is punishment for sin is only one of many that you can find in Chazal. One of the most amazing treatments of evil, if you take out now your source books, is on page one of the source book. There is a passage in Maseches Moed Katan. It's a remarkable passage. I've purposely given you the art scroll in order to add authenticity to the passage. Okay. Okay. Amar Rava. Rava says, Chaye b'nei u'mezone, the length of a person's life, the number of his children, and the extent of his sustenance, three pretty important things in your life. Lo bischuso talia milsa, it's not dependent upon your merit. Ela bimazola talia milsa, it depends on mazel, meaning on the astrological flow. And he brings a proof. He says, the Haraba Rav Chista Tarvayu Rabbanan Tzadikehavi. Rabba and Rav Chista were both righteous rabbis, as is evident from the fact that one would pray for rain and rain would fall, and the other would pray for rain and rain would fall. Equally righteous. Yet Rav Chista lived 92 years, whereas Rabba lived only 40 years. Rav Chista's household celebrated 60 weddings. Rava's household suffered 60 bereavements. Rav Chisda's household fed bread, the fine flour, to their dogs, and it was not needed. Whereas Rava's household fed bread, the barley flour, to people, and not enough of it could be found. Two sages, equally righteous, equally in touch with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, yet they had very different outcomes in life. Lo b'schusa talya milsa, it didn't depend upon their merit, it depended upon the mazel. I take this to basically be throwing in the towel on trying to understand how God operates, and in fact it seems to maintain that God is not playing a role, it's not a direct role, in what happens in a person's life. Now the Rishonim add something to this, and they maintain that actually a righteous person can have the ability to override the mazel. But even if you take that position, it's still difficult to understand why Rabbah could not override his mazel. And so as you see, there really is a very wide range of views in Chazal. And now what I would like to do is to try to explain what I think is the Rav's contribution. We're going to be doing this through a text, a number of pages from the book Out of the Whirlwind, and I want to first maybe explain it sort of, as they used to say, outside, so you stay in the base medrash, explain it outside, and then go into the text. I warn you that the text is somewhat intimidating, and it reminds me of the story of the philosopher who lost his job in academia, and he went to work for the mafia. And his first day on the job, he walked up to somebody, shoved a gun in the person's ribs, and he said to him, "I'm going to make you an offer that you can't understand." In any case, let me first explain to you what I think is the basic point the Rav is making in the pages that we will look at. There is much else that he writes on this subject that doesn't really fit the model that I'm describing, but I think these are particularly interesting pages. Suppose that you believe that suffering is punishment for sin. And then you see somebody suffering. What should you do, logically? Well, if he's being punished, who are you to take him out of jail early? It seems that if the person is suffering for that reason, is God wants him to suffer, then how can you stop the suffering? Or suppose that you think a person is suffering as a kapara, as an atonement. Well, certainly you wouldn't want to stop the atonement in its tracks. Or suppose you say that this is Yisurin Shalava, that this righteous person is suffering more in this world in order to increase his reward in the next. Well, why try to help him? After all, if you try to help him, you are decreasing his reward in the next world. And so on and so forth for various theodicies. What's happening here is this. What's the aim of a theodicy? The aim of a theodicy is essentially to make your peace with evil. It's essentially an attempt to try to place evil in a larger, beautiful framework in which it all makes sense. That's the aim of theodicy. But on the other hand, you are a moral agent and you are a halachic agent. And moral agency and halachic agency dictates that you make war on evil. I mean, not to sound too much like George Bush, that's what it is. You make war on evil. So the theodicy has you make peace. Moral action, halachic action, is an all-out war against evil. So really, all of us then are caught between these two sides. On the one hand, trying to justify God's ways and make everything make sense. And on the other hand, trying to fight evil wherever it appears. Now, I believe that this is what Rav Soloveitchik is getting at in the pages that we will do. So let's do them, and then I'm going to compare it to something that he wrote later on. Background. In the prior pages, the pages prior to this, the Rav draws a distinction between two types of halacha. One of them he calls topical halacha, and the other one he calls thematic halacha. Topical halacha comes from the Greek word topos, meaning surface. So you have surface halacha. Thematic is related to the idea of a root. So you have root halacha. So we have surface halacha, we have root halacha. What does that mean? Well, essentially, there are two ways that you can conceive of halacha. This is what he's saying. You can conceive of halacha as a set of rules, a set of do's and don'ts, or you can conceive of halacha as embodying or expressing certain kinds of metaphysical ideas, philosophical ideas. That would be the thematic halacha. So the surface halacha treats halacha as a set of rules. The thematic halacha treats halacha as philosophical. Example that he gives, Shabbos. As a top, from the point of view of topical halacha, Shabbos involves a set of rules, what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, mutar and asar. From a thematic point of view, Shabbos embodies a value of kedusha, and that is what it really amounts to. So the topical looks at it one way, the thematic looks at it another way. That's the distinction between the topical and the thematic. Now, frankly, I would actually say, I'm not sure I'm right about this, that when he talks about thematic halacha, he's really ultimately talking about what we would call agoda. In other words, the non-legal portions of the Talmud. That he's speaking here about philosophical things, philosophical themes. And that, generally speaking, is part of the agoda. Why he used the term halacha for agoda is a question, you know, but I'm just saying that this is sort of my observation about this. This is the way I understand what he means by thematic halacha. But it won't really matter for any practical purpose. In fact, philosophy doesn't matter for any practical purpose. Okay. Now, let's take a look at what you have as page 2 of the source book. The Rav describes here one way in which the thematic halacha treats evil. Actually, more than one way. Let's stick with one way, which the thematic halacha treats evil. And it's embodied on the right-hand side of the page, right? Gemara Kedushin. To what are the righteous compared in this world? To a tree standing holy in a place of cleanness, but whose bough overhangs to a place of uncleanness. When the bough is lopped off, it stands entirely in a place of cleanness. Thus, the Holy One brings suffering upon the righteous in this world in order that they may inherit the future world. That is an example of the thematic halacha. It's one of the theodicies that I mentioned before. He also gives another example of the thematic halacha on the next page, where he speaks of an approach called universalism. And he says, the motif of universalism is employed by the thematic halacha in a similar fashion. This is under the heading universalism. Again, the thematic halacha maintains the universal doctrine of suffering, that evil as a universal entity does not exist, that it is nothing but a chimera, just a figment of our fantasy. In other words, the idea is that according to the thematic halacha, evil does not really exist. The only thing that really exists is good. The first time I ever read this passage aloud, I got to that word, chimera, which I knew meant illusion. The only problem is I didn't know how to pronounce it. I mean, I could understand it in reading. I didn't know how to pronounce it. So I don't know exactly how I read it. Some people thought I said chumra. Some people thought I said camera. I don't know. So somebody told me, here's the way you pronounce it. So the next time I spoke, I told the story of what happened the first time, and then I pronounced it what I thought was correctly. And again, it turned out someone told me it was still incorrect. So the third time, I thought I had it right. I told a story about what happened the first two times. And I said, chimera. and there was this classicist in the audience, and he said, chimera. So I said, okay, finally I got it right. So now I have chimera. That evil is just a chimera. It's a figment of our fantasy. He says, moreover, if you can go down to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the ninth line of the paragraph. Moreover, the thematic halacha maintains that sufferings of the individual are ministerial to a higher good within the universal order. In other words, the individual suffering serves some higher purpose. And basing this doctrine upon the passage in Genesis, and God saw all things that he had made, v'hinei tov ma'od, behold, it was very good. The whole world is good. That means that even evil is good. Now, there's a statement by Rabbi Meir in the Medrash, which the Rav is now going to refer to. Rabbi Meir says on the words v'hinei tov ma'od, he says this includes maves, that even maves is good. Writes the Rav, Rabbi Meir was a man who knew suffering in his private life. He lost two children. He lost his wife. He lost his father-in-law. And he died a martyr's death. His marginal remark that at twilight of the mysterious Friday, it was the first Friday, when creation was concluded, God cast a glance and found even death to be good, even maves, attests to the universalistic view of our sages. That is, that our sages viewed evil as part of a larger totality that was good. And he gives other examples of this. For example, in Yeshaya, we read God says that he is Yotzer Or Uvarei Choshech, Oseh Shalom Uvarei Ra. God says, I create evil. How do we have the bracha in our davening? Yotzer Or Uvarei Choshech, Oseh Shalom Uvareyes Hakol. Meaning, the totality of things, God creates the totality. Apparently, writes the Rav, in the perspective of totality, evil vanishes. That's the thematic halacha. Thematic halacha sees evil as fitting into a beautiful, harmonious picture. What about the topical halacha? The topical halacha takes a completely opposite approach. That's on page 4. The topical halacha, and again, that means halacha conceived as a system of rules, rules which tell you how to act, rules actually which particularly dictate that you try to relieve suffering where it exists. The topical halacha could not accept the thematic metaphysic, which tends to gloss over the absurdity of evil, and it did not engage in the building of a magnificent philosophical facade to shut out the ugly sights of an inadequate existence. In other words, the topical halacha was going to accept evil for what it is. Look at the last sentence of the next paragraph. The topical halacha is an open-eyed, tough observer of things and events. And instead of indulging in a speculative metaphysic, in other words, instead of trying to understand why evil exists, it acknowledged boldly both the reality of evil and its irrationality, its absurdity. As a case in point, let us examine the topical halacha's attitude toward death, which was idealized by the thematic metaphysic, right? V'hinei tov ma'od includes maves, so that's an idealization of death. Writes the Rav, it is enough to glance at the laws of mourning in order to convince ourselves that the topical halacha saw death as a dreadful fiend with whom no pact may be reached, no reconciliation is possible. In the act of mourning for a deceased member of the household, the whole traumatic horror in the face of an insensate and absurd experience asserts itself. Death appears in all its monstrosity and absurdity, and an encounter with it knocks out the bottom of human existence. If the topical halacha concurred with the thematic in its interpretation of death as deliverance, or as a thought that death is such a great thing, as a victory over nihility, then why mourn and grieve for the departed? Why rend our garments, sit on the floor, and say, Baruch Dayan Emet, which I think here he takes to mean simply you accept the judgment without seeing how it fits into the larger whole. That is the approach of the topical halacha. Down near the bottom, he makes an interesting remark about the topical halacha. He said, four lines from the bottom, of course it, meaning topical halacha, could not accommodate evil. But there is a difference between accommodating evil and handling evil. Some guests I'm eager to accommodate. Some guests I do not want to accommodate. But if somebody knocks at my door, I must answer, responding and handling him, even by taking his lapel and throwing him out. So the question is, how did the topical halacha handle evil, not how did it accommodate it? It made no accommodation. There was no accommodation for evil within the framework of topical halacha. Simply, the framework is a realistic one, and a realistic framework cannot have a place or position within its coordinate system for evil and suffering. Yet, whether or not we are ready to accommodate evil, we must deal with it. And what he then says is that the topical halacha has evolved an ethic of suffering. What to do in the face of suffering, instead of a metaphysic of suffering. And this ethic, by the way, entails not only helping people who are in distress, it also entails looking into your own deeds, using it as an opportunity. It entails sometimes trying to see your own finitude and thereby smash dreams of immortality. And the Rav says that until his bout of cancer, he had these dreams of immortality. And then he came to understand his own limitations, his own mortality. There are many things that you can get out of an experience of evil. That's the ethic of suffering. But it's not a metaphysic of suffering. You know, sometimes one little anecdote can illustrate a philosophical point. I live in New York, and the New York Mets, I assume people know that, you know, Mets is not the name of the city in Germany or something like that, right? The New York Mets were playing a game. It was on Mother's Day. And they had two announcers, Tim McCarver and Ralph Kiner. Now, Ralph Kiner was known for his sort of malapropisms and various other ineptitudes. And Tim McCarver was a very, very sharp guy. Anyway, so Tim McCarver said, and to all you mothers out there, happy Mother's Day. And Ralph Kiner said to him, Tim, how are you celebrating Mother's Day? And Tim McCarver said, well, my mother is looking on from a higher place. To which Ralph said, oh, glad to hear it, Tim. Now, after all, he's right. If she's looking on from a better place, then, you know, why grieve for her? Okay, glad to hear it. Okay. Finally, the Rav gives what he calls three pillars of the halachic ethic of suffering. He says, to sum up, I would say the halachic suffering ethic of suffering rests upon three propositions. First, evil does exist, and evil is bad. The world in which we live is not free from deformities and inadequacies which result in the perennial discord between the interests of man and the unalterable laws of nature. In other words, the reality of evil is indisputable. Second, one must never acquiesce in evil, make peace with it, or condone its existence. Defiance of an active opposition to evil, employing all means that God put at a man's disposal, is the dominant norm in halacha. And here you see why the Rav was so in favor of science and technology. Scientific intervention on behalf of man in his desperate struggle for control of his environment is fully endorsed and justified. And I won't bother to read the third proposition of these three. But I think it's very clear then the contrast between the thematic halacha and the topical halacha. Something strange has happened in this essay. The Rav began by saying that there are two approaches. There's the thematic approach, there's the topical approach. By the time you reach the point that we reached, you get the feeling that the thematic halacha has been left in the dust. That really what counts for him is the topical halacha. And the thematic halacha is something that exists in our tradition, but it's marginalized, and he pushes it out perhaps altogether. Now, here's an interesting thing that happened. In 1965, Dr. Dan Vogel, who was then the dean at Stern College for Women, wrote to the Rav for a kind of digest of what he had said about this in this discourse. And here's what the Rav wrote. The gist of my discourse was that Judaism did not approach the problem of evil under the speculative metaphysical aspect, for such an inquiry would be a futile undertaking. And he goes on to say the human mind cannot resolve the dilemma of evil. Therefore, he says, man should not ask why evil, but ask what am I supposed to do if confronted with evil. Now, there are two ways, I think, in which this summary of his discourse contrasts with the way I interpreted the discourse. First, his sentence that Judaism did not approach the problem of evil under the speculative metaphysical aspect. I mean, he's told us that there was a tradition of the thematic halacha that did approach evil under the thematic halacha, under the speculative metaphysical aspect. Yet here, he has shunted it aside. Second, the reason for rejecting the inquiry into the thematic halacha is that it's futile. We'll never know the answer. That was not what was argued in the discourse. What was argued there, as I am interpreting, remember Maimonides is life and thought, but as I am interpreting it, there what seemed to be the case is that if you have a speculative metaphysical resolution of why evil exists, then it's going to paralyze you as a moral agent, as a halachic agent. That does not seem to appear here. Just to make things still more confusing, in 1956, 5 years before he gave the discourse that I was reading from before, he took a position which was far more like what he wrote to Dr. Vogel. So the position in 1961 in the pages we read is, I think, you know, a bit of what they call a yotze dofen, a bit of an exception in the way in which he writes about evil. But at the same time, I believe that the problem it raises is a very, very serious problem for any theodicy. Now, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, wrote concerning what the Rav had said about where the Rav wrote that the basically something to the effect that Judaism does not have this metaphysical speculative note when it deals with evil. He wrote, quote, as a summary of the attitudes of Yahadut in general, this strikes me as overly sweeping. And yet, that is what the Rav did. He seems to have pushed it out. Now, in other words, the point is that it's not simply what I've been presenting is not simply the idea that's perhaps familiar to a lot of you, that the Rav says, don't ask why there's evil, but ask what you can do about it, because you can't understand evil. What I'm saying is I think that there is a deeper reason why not to speculate, because the speculation, again, interferes with your moral agency. I'd like to close this talk. Every time I say the words in closing, I think of a time that I was a teenager, and I was at a convention, and I think Dr. Safran was actually at the same convention. It was the Yavne convention. I was sitting, and we were listening to a rabbi speaking, and he said, in closing, and then this 8-year-old kid sitting in front of me says, 10 more minutes. You know, ready? I'll give you one more. There's a story about a speaker who was going on for too long, and he noticed that people were fidgeting. So he said, I'm sorry, I didn't have a watch. So somebody yelled out, no, but there's a calendar behind you. Anyway, let me close by contrasting what we read of the Rav with a Ramban. A Ramban that's found in Kisvei HaRamban. The Ramban has, up until the point from which we'll pick up the reading, the Ramban has given what he believes is an adequate theodicy based upon the teachings of Chazal. It's not important exactly what he holds, but just know that he held to a theodicy. Then let's go to the English on page 8, and I just want to show you something about the Hebrew. He says, you may ask us the following question. Now, somebody may turn to me, Ramban, and ask, since there is a hidden element in divine judgment, and we must believe in his righteousness as the true judge, praised and exalted be he. Why then do you trouble us by commanding us to learn the previously explained arguments and the secret to which you have alluded? Because we know that God is righteous. We know that there's some hidden element in his justice. So why did you, Ramban, bother to try to find out what the explanation is? Why can we not thrust everything upon the belief, which we must ultimately rely on, that God is the one with whom there is neither unrighteousness nor forgetfulness, since all his words of decrees are effectuated with justice? Now, what's the big deal? Why are you, you know, my kol ha-torah chazeh? What are you bothering with all this for? After all, we know that God is righteous. To which the Ramban says, this is an argument of fools who despise wisdom. Ksilim ma'aseh ha-chachmah. With the enlightenment we have attained, in other words, by having an adequate theodicy, we can benefit ourselves by becoming wise and knowing God, blessed be he, through his manner and deeds. In other words, we can become wise and we can actually know God better. Moreover, we will believe and trust in his faith in both the known and hidden matters more than other people, because we will be learning to understand the concealed matters from the explicit ones. We will recognize the fairness of the divine judgment and the justice of the divine decision. Thus, it is the duty of every person who worships God out of love and fear to search his mind in order to justify the divine decision and to substantiate the judgment as far as his ability allows. To be an Oved Me'avo Me'yira, you have to investigate why God allows evil. This justification should be done according to the methods of the sages, which we have explained on the basis of their words. He will thus have a lucid opinion in this matter and will verify to himself the judgment of his Creator as one who justifies that which he recognizes and knows as truth. He will then be able to recognize the judgment and the justice even in that area which is hidden from him. Totally the opposite from the Rav. Theodicy is an imperative. The Rav put theodicy in the corner. The Ramban brings it out front and center. And I was struck by one phrase in the Hebrew, and maybe this is a little bit of Drush. Dr. Lustiger will have to tell me if it really fits the definition of Drush. It's a little bit of Drush. The Hebrew, if you go to page 7, when the Ramban is explaining why you have to explore these theodicies, page 7, you see, you have the underlined lines, and I pardon the fuzzy quality of this. I got the Xerox from the Ramban himself, so okay. Why must one explore this? Kidei shetisyashev da'ato ba'inyan. In order that he achieve yishuv hadas, composure of the mind. And then he goes on to say, and he will, you know, vindicate God's din. This phrase, Kidei shetisyashev da'ato, really struck me. You'll get yishuv hadas out of having a theodicy. Maybe, this is the Drush part, this is the key to understanding the difference between the Ramban and the Rav. That for the Ramban, your aim in your religious life, or one of your aims, is Kidei Shetis Yashev Dato. It's Yishuv Hadas. But Yishuv Hadas for the Rav is almost the last thing that's going to be part of the religious experience. And to end where I began, HaChavaya HaDatit Chavayat Sevelhi, that religious experience is the experience of suffering, of pain, of crisis, and torment. What an optimistic way to end. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll just take 5 minutes of questions.
By the way, I just realized I left out 5 minutes of application. That's yeah, sorry about this. Okay.
Just a few minutes of question.
Would the halacha of Kaddish, after someone dies, fall in topical halacha, or would it be in the practical halacha?
Well, I think there he maintains, you see, in a lot of these cases, he has some, you know, a sort of homiletic explanation of things, but I don't think that the Kaddish is meant to justify It's not meant to justify God's ways. Usually it is something within the person, and it's to create some sort of change within the person. And he talks about it. I don't remember exactly the discussion, but is it in Worship of the Heart? I don't remember exactly where he discusses Kaddish. Or maybe it's in Out of the Whirlwind, and I didn't do my homework. But it's okay. It's not so much about justifying God's ways. No.
I don't recall where, but the Ramban also says that you can't understand God's ways, which would seem to contradict. And there's no, I can get to you the citation, but I don't know it offhand, which would seem to contradict what he's saying here, which is similar to the Rav seemingly contradicting himself in this area.
Okay, I have to see the Ramban, I guess.
Did the Rav comment on, I think it's one of the sages that said in the Talmud, I forget where, that the reasons for evil and suffering in the world are related to the lack of morality, continuous lack of morality, and that, again, as you said earlier, the innocent suffer with the guilty, but it's this connection between evil and a lack of morality, and then that puts the responsibility back on us that we can do something about on that level, the existence of evil.
Yeah, okay, my understanding from what I have seen, and I guess what I've been saying, is that the connection between evil and morality is something like this, that it's not that the evil is explained by the lack of morality, because that brings you into the realm of this speculative metaphysic, but rather the morality is the proper response to the evil. So there is a relationship, but it's by way of response. Now, there's a very confusing passage in Kol Dodi Dofeik where it seems that he is actually coming very close to saying that Eov suffered because he sinned. And you have to read it very carefully and with some sort of a nuancing of the words, I think, to keep it within this domain that I'm suggesting, that it's not, again, lack of morality per se that explains the evil, but rather it's... It's not, what do they call this again? It's not the logic of explanation, it's the logic of response.
We won't find that in that book.
I think it's implied in the pages that we read, but I don't recall him addressing it elsewhere.
Yeah. I was going to throw one in, actually. Rashi brings down a chazal in Parshas Noach about Andra Lamusia, right? That when there are certain sins in the generation, that this kind of indiscriminate good with bad, how would the Rav sort of think about the notion that somebody can get caught up in, so to speak, somebody else's business. When Rashi brings down this midrash that when you have avodah zarah and arayot,
right,
andra lamusia balo olam,
right,
this kind
right,
of
right,
indiscriminate
right.
killing,
right.
that kind of wrong place, wrong time type of thing. Would the Rav see that as a viable notion?
That could be a natural, some sort of natural outgrowth, and there's some sort of naturalistic explanation of what happens rather than something which is a punishment. Because he sees certain sorts of orientations as leading to certain sorts of bad things. The absence of vikashta misham, certain kind of religious orientation can lead to destructiveness and so forth. Okay,
great.
Can I just mention what I wanted to mention before? Yeah, I left out... what was originally 5 minutes. Let me just tell you in 2 minutes something that I wanted to say and sort of kind of skipped over. There are sort of two applications. What I wanted to mention is two applications of the Rav's idea in contemporary times. One, if you remember a couple of years ago when the Versailles wedding hall collapsed, there was some statement by some rabbi or other, or maybe more than one, that it collapsed because there was improper dancing at the wedding. Now, forget about the question of whether the classic theodicy is true or there are other theodicies and so forth. From the Rav's point of view, what's the point of saying that? What's the effect of saying it? The effect of saying it is basically to say, look, these people got what they deserved. End of it, no tragedy. And that's a mistake. That's one application of it. In other words, that these sorts of statements are wrong, not even because they don't have the explanation right, but because they take away from us the sensitivity to the magnitude of what happened. The second explanation is one that was the second application is something that came up after 9/11, you know, someone immediately found the Zohar, which said that 70 days before Mashiach will come, two big buildings will be destroyed, and, you know, so it was all fated. And this sort of thing happens whenever there is a tragedy. People look to find the tragedy in the Parsha or somewhere else. And the Mashgiach Ruchani at Yeshiva, Yeshiva University, Rabbi Yosef Blau, wrote the following in reaction to these sorts of explanations that it was all fated. He says, if the crash of two helicopters, which happened, I think, in 1997, 73 people were killed in the crash of two helicopters, if it was foreseen by the prophet Yeshayahu, that instead of a problem of how a just God could have allowed the tragedy to happen, we have another indication that we're living in an era where prophecies are being fulfilled. In other words, people, instead of taking it as a tragedy, they take it as, well, it's just the fulfillment of a prophecy. Unable to find a rational explanation for all that's occurring, many have turned to messianic speculation. And he says, dealing with the complexities and inconsistencies of actual events is no longer necessary. So, in other words, that's basically what you're doing. It's a coping mechanism. When you try to find these things in the Parsha, and you simply say, or in the Zohar or whatever, and you simply say, well, okay, it was all fated. That's also the sort of thing that I believe the Rav would fiercely oppose, on the grounds that this is thematic halacha, and we have to act in accordance with topical halacha. And these sorts of explanations have the potential to take away our sensitivity to the magnitude of what happened and to what we have to do in its wake. That's the part that I had left out. Okay, thank you.